Well, Mr. Burns,
there are Ringer listeners who thought that I was a Korean man. I don't know why. I have a conspiracy theory that it's because one of my coworkers, who is also an audio producer who left, was a Korean man. And so they were like, well, every Ringer producer must just be a Korean man.
You're like the menswear guy on Twitter. Everyone's like, is he Asian or not? It's driving me crazy. I'm going to fight I see thinking it's him.
Please never compare me to the menswear guy on Twitter again. Come on.
You don't like that guy?
I like him. I like him just fine, but I'm not. I'm a poster, but I'm not that much of a poster.
Yeah. You know? Cool. You want to just jump into it?
Yeah. Do you need us to record like a local file and send it over or anything?
No. I think this is a good quality. I'll record it on here. Just have it doubled, but then I record on my computer. I think it'll be fine.
Okay, great.
And how much time do you have to talk?
I am good for like an hour.
Okay, that should be fine
if that works.
Yeah,
we just have to do our pod.
Ooh, double hours.
And oh, did you freeze, Alex?
Yeah, my Wi-Fi cut out for a second, so I just really
okay. Can't trust that Brooklyn Wi-Fi.
Nope. The StreamYard just told me, pro tip, plugging into the internet is better than Wi-Fi. Oh yeah. let me just plug my computer into the internet right now.
I got that same Ethernet too. Cable. Yeah. When I went to college, my mom sent me with an Ethernet cable. My mom, who had been working from home, she was like the original work from home queen. She was working from home since the 90s, so she had many experiences with terrible Wi-Fi. And so she always would plug in hardwired with the Ethernet. So when she sent me to college, she was like, you have to have an Ethernet cable. And so for the first 2 weeks of college, I was like, well, it's not going to work unless I have an Ethernet cable. And then I was like, I got to give up on this.
Yeah. If you're doing a big transfer, the Ethernet cable's nice. But we're not here to talk about cables and Wi-Fi troubles. We're here to talk about baseball with the hosts of the Tipping Pitches podcast, Alex Baisley, and former closer of the New York Mets, Bobby Wagner. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, I don't throw 100 anymore, and I'm also suddenly right-handed, but, you know, a lot of good memories along the way.
And so, after your career, you met Alex at NYU. Why did you choose to become an undergrad at NYU after your MLB career?
Oh, man, what a question. I was sold by the New York University marketing department on the dream school.
We are in and of the city.
In and of the city, New York University. The real answer, like many people, is that I got rejected by Columbia University, and so I was like, I'll just go to NYU.
Okay.
But I wanted to be in New York. I have a lot of family in New York. My mom grew up on Long Island. I grew up outside of Philadelphia, so grew up a Mets fan, being tortured and punished by Philadelphia fans my whole life.
I wonder if that's even, because I grew up in Westchester as a Mets fan in a school of Yankees fans, but there was like a couple Mets fans and there was some acknowledgement that like, well, we don't like the Mets. We think they're gay, but it is a New York team. It must've been way worse.
Oh, it was so bad. It was so bad, bro. Just like straight up bullying for no reason for my Mets fandom. Yeah. And I was ready to, as our good friend Morgan Wallen would say, come back to God's country. And that was New York City.
Did you really just do that?
Just reference Morgan Wallen again? I've been trying to rope you into making comments about that for weeks now, Alex.
I know.
I don't know who that was, so I just passed over my mind. I'm like, I'm not going to ask. We have other stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
That's how I ended up at NYU, and I was lucky enough to meet Alex along the way. And then we started Tipping Pitches in our junior year of college because we were tired of staying up till 4 a.m. arguing about baseball players, and so we decided to do it in the afternoon instead and post it as a podcast. And now, all these years later, we care a lot more about labor, care a lot more about collective bargaining agreements, and we care a lot more about Alex Rodriguez. And those are the things that we cover week in and week out.
Alex Rodriguez is a great character. Maybe we'll get into him a little bit later. But yeah, so you got on my radar because I'm writing this book about the Mets, and part of what I'm trying to figure out with this book is, you know, the nature of baseball labor relations and your show. And there's just very little information out there about the MLBPA, about what's going on inside of it, about like what the things in the CBA mean. You know, it's kind of opaque to a fan perspective. And your podcast does a pretty good job, especially during the negotiations, the previous two, like really looking at what it is and how it's shaping up. And it's very impressive because, you know, besides a couple athletic writers, there's not much out there.
Yeah. I mean, part of that is like the nature of sports media these days, too, right? Is like, where else are you going to get it besides sort of the one place that's snapping up all the writers? And they do some wonderful coverage over there. But you're right that there is a sort of dearth of critical media that is interested in engaging with like the undercurrents of the labor dynamics of the game, right? It's a man hit ball far. That's fun. And I think it is fun. I do think that's fun. but isn't it so fun to like, you know, talk about pension plans too?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. And arbitration.
Oh, yeah.
That's what gets me up in the morning.
Joint drug testing agreements. Yeah. We love to dig into that stuff. Talk about salary arbitration. Yeah. I mean, I think it's twofold, right? That there's like a lack of incentive from the corporate media side because they don't want to upset the rights holders. They don't want to upset the people in power. They know that they have to cover these teams week in and week out, and these teams can make their lives hard if they take the kind of hardline stance that Alex and I take in our independently produced baseball podcast with a moderate following. That's not really what these like corporate media partners are looking to do. And I think the other thing is like there is this perception that fans don't care about this stuff. And I think something that has been really important to us is trying to relate both how this is like what your boss is doing to you. And so you should care about this if you're a baseball fan who likes to think critically about the world. And also, this stuff is just interesting, like for a number of reasons. There's a lot of characters involved in this, and it dictates so much more of your fandom than you even know. And I think what we've been trying to do is make the case that the inner machinations of the Players Association and the labor dynamics of baseball are just everywhere, like in every experience of modern fandom.
Yeah, so by the end of this episode, even if you don't care about baseball, even if you're in Serbia and you don't even know how it's played, you will care deeply about arbitration eligibility in the 2026 CBA negotiations. You'll be following
That's right.
it.
That's the hope. That's the That's our promise.
yeah, so I want to talk to you a lot about labor relations and baseball history. And today, I also want to talk to you about the 2025 season itself, just talk about the teams and the players and the dingers and all that. And I also want to talk to you about like why we talk about baseball in this time when there's a fascist takeover, financial collapse, an ongoing genocide. So those are the three topics I want to cover. I'll let you choose which we can talk about first.
Let's start with the 2025 season. We'll get all the Mets angst out of the way.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I'm not feeling particularly angsty. You know, it hasn't been great. So, you know, they're number one in the East, so it's fine. But really my concern, and maybe it's like this is a little bit less this week than last week, is that the Dodgers and the Yankees would just win every game and go back to the World Series. And my concern is not only about that, because I don't want to see another Dodgers-Yankees World Series. I don't want to see them dominate so much, but that would be really bad for competitive imbalance leading into 2026 CBA negotiations.
Yeah. There's this this anti-Dodger sentiment that has been brewing for a few years, and I think really comes out of the fact that like the Yankees are no longer the capital Y Yankees like they used to be, the evil empire that they used to be. And so everybody is kind of trying to see, they have this dissociated anger towards large markets, and they've been trying to land it in one place. And you know, it still sticks sometimes on the Mets, and it still sticks sometimes on the Yankees, but it really has come into focus against the Dodgers this year for spending all of this money, for being owned by an international global asset management firm. They're owned by, for folks who don't know, they're owned by Guggenheim, which is
not the art museum.
Yeah. What is it, Bobby?
They manage rich people's money. They manage rich companies' money. They control billions and billions of dollars in assets. And the Dodgers ownership group is really headlined by this guy, Mark Walter, who is like, I believe, the CEO of Guggenheim. And they seem to have unlimited resources, and they spend them in a sort of a longitudinal way. And they've sort of broken the model in MLB ownership, which is don't step out of line, you know, don't get too far beyond your skis and make the smaller market teams look too cheap for operating the way that they have for all of baseball history.
Don't sign all the free agents.
Yes. Don't sign. Don't spend so much and make it so brash that we can't look like we were competitive in keeping our own players around and making fans happy by doing that. And, you know, Alex and I have spent a lot of time looking at baseball history and the ways that different owners have behaved and gotten themselves, I guess, on the outs with their fellow cohort of owners in that time. And what's happening with, I think, with the Dodgers is unique in the sense that it's like, it's not one guy acting out of line in the way that maybe Steve Cohen is, and he has way more money than everyone else, and he's signing all these good players. It's like, we're really in the era of like, just the Wall Streetification of Major League Baseball teams. And as we've seen in the rest of American society, right? Like, there comes a time when this is just so much money that they are, not to say a phrase that like hits too big of a pinpoint, especially in this current moment, like too big to fail. And I think we're seeing a little bit of like a too big to fail moment for the Los Angeles Dodgers right now.
In baseball, you know, anything can happen. The Dodgers could, you know, the other teams in the NL West are looking very strong. So it's possible that the Dodgers don't even win the division or they get knocked out in an early round. But from the last playoffs, they looked just unstoppable. And I think there was this fear that overcame even people who hate the Yankees and were glad to see them lose, that maybe there was something charming about the Yankees, kind of like Steinbrenner was like a, you know, a U.S. industrialist who like made his fortune from a shipping company. And
logistics, baby. We love to do logistics and make $6 billion by doing logistics.
And then Steve Cohen is, you know, a hedge fund manager who's like a criminal, but kind of like a charming criminal, you know, like portrayed in Billions as Bobby Axelrod, like a rock star renegade billionaire who like likes art and at least portrays himself as like willing to take a huge loss on the Mets. But then Guggenheim is this other sort of monstrous corporation who's not only spending, can outspend everybody except for maybe Steve Cohen, certainly can outspend the Yankees, but also is turning a huge profit. So they're not just doing it because they love the Dodgers. They may or may not love the Dodgers, but they've really figured out how to turn the Dodgers into a team that's competitively and economically way stronger than all the other teams.
Yeah, well, and they've done it top to bottom, too, right? It's not just throwing money at the biggest free agent or something like that. It is taking the time to modernize, really, their baseball development and operations team. And frankly, they do it really well, right? I think the Dodgers have realized, and they are able to come to this realization because they are making a profit and because they have so much money, but like that actually the new market inefficiency is like spending a little too much. Like that's like overspending on a player actually is okay if you're recouping that value or whatever on the front end. That's okay if you're still paying Shohei Ohtani's contract 20 years from now, because the trade-off is obviously that you get Shohei Ohtani for the next 20 years. And I mean, a lot of the discourse around the Dodgers and the Yankees and the Mets is really downstream of decades of the ownership class successfully convincing fans that you should think like an owner, right? That if you overpay on a player, that's by definition a bad thing, right? That is a problem because that's money that couldn't be allocated elsewhere. And they've done a really good job at that. And, you know, to talk about the media, like the media for a really long time did a good job of carrying that water and reflecting those views. And so that was the only view that as a fan you were getting, right? You were saying, oh, well, the Albert Pujols contract looks really bad right now. I bet we don't want to do that again. The refrain we always come back to is like, it's not our money. Paying Albert Pujols for a contract that he is or isn't living up to actually doesn't have a material impact on my life because I'm interested in hitting home runs to the extent that he can. And when he doesn't, then that's fine. Mm-hmm. I'll watch Mike Trout next. It's okay.
Yeah, but you do have to feel bad for the smaller market teams. Like they might be owned by billionaires themselves or people who could conceivably spend more money, but you know, like, for example, the Blue Jays are owned by Rogers, who's like the telecommunications company. They also have billions to spend, but they just seem to not be able to outspend the Yankees and the Mets and the Dodgers. Or maybe they just want to seem like they can't. But it does. Do you have to feel bad for those fans and like empathize with that feeling that like there's not only a competitive imbalance, but there's also just an imbalance in who owns the teams. And maybe my team needs to be owned by like Elon Musk or something, so we can actually. So they can actually have fuck you money being spent.
I think there's a couple of refrains that we usually come back to with that sentiment. I mean, the number one thing is that, yes, it's I do feel bad for fans whose ownership has, you know, put their own limitations on what they can do, these arbitrary limitations based on how much profit they'd like to take home, come rain or come shine, you know? We joke all the time that, like, you know, labor doesn't get to participate in the high end of the profits in any industry. So why should we punish labor? In this case, it's the players, for when there's like an economic downturn that owners are feeling the brunt of. But they come back to these things all of the time because it's an easy, you know, PR line to say like, oh, we didn't take in as much money during the pandemic. It's like, well, how about for the 20 years consecutive before that, where you were setting records for how much you were making in ticket sales and TV rights and all these different things. You know, I think what we often come back to is like, yeah, but does that mean we want the Dodgers to lower their ceiling? Or do we want to get rid of this sort of cohort thinking of the middle to lower tier market owners who have this like scarcity mindset that has effectively convinced their fans that they're just like not good and they're never going to be good. And if they are good, it's from sheer luck. And that the big bad Dodgers and Yankees are here to take every good thing that's ever happened to you away from you at the first light of day for that good thing. And, you know, for the most part throughout baseball history, that kind of mindset of that smaller to middle tier owner has just dominated. And that's kind of what I was alluding to when I was talking about like the Guggenheims of the world, the Steve Cohens of the world, making themselves into the one villain of the league. Is because owners don't like it when you step too far out of line and in doing so create a contrast to show the rest of the fans, oh, this is what it could be like. This is what my life could be like. And we've also seen super, super wealthy owners who come in and it's like they don't, their personal wealth doesn't matter how much they spend. It's more about what they perceive their market and the team's income to be. And now you get into the point where it's like, yes, but are they making less money in their market because fans don't like that team? Or are they making less money in their market because they're just bad businessmen or intentionally bad businessmen because it's more profitable to be mediocre and cash revenue sharing checks? Because these owners, we haven't even talked about, is that they share the revenue. They do socialism on the capital side in a way that they're not willing to let us talk about in the rest of society. Uh-huh. That's way too out of line. But yes, that's a whole other can of worms.
Yeah, it's interesting, like, trying to go back through baseball history, which we'll maybe we can try to do that a little bit later on, and looking at how the organized baseball, or Major League Baseball as it came to be known, was this sort of collective of capitalists in a monopolistic industry who, you know, they have the monopoly, but they also have to have some sort of politics between one another and factions and deciding about how to make sure they can make as much profit as possible while still keeping the game balanced and competitive, because that's where the meaning of the game comes from. So there's this interesting tension for the first 100 years of baseball or so, where the capitalists have to actually do these sort of politics between each other to keep the game entertaining, keep it profitable. And then when there's a real baseball union in the 60s, then there's like another side of that, which is the labor side of it. But before we get there, we haven't really talked about the 2025 season at all. Maybe you can both like talk about a story or a player or a game that you were both interested in the last, you know, what are we like 12 games in so far, 15 games in?
I mean, I have to say, as a born and raised Oakland A's fan, yes, that is the Oakland A's. I'm fascinated by what's happening in Sacramento right now, not because it excites me to turn on an A's game these days, but because you never know what might happen. I saw a bullpen cart broke down in, I think, last night's game. And I think that's awesome because you can take the Coliseum out of the team, but, you know, or you can take the team out of the Coliseum. There we go. Can't take the Coliseum out of the team. I just think that storyline, and again, I know you're going to keep trying to pull us towards talking about real baseball, and
we don't have to.
We're going to pull us back towards, but like, I think that that storyline is a really fascinating example of just how modern baseball works and operates, right? The protections that it is afforded, and how that trickles down to the actual product on the field. So, I mean, for the listeners who aren't aware, right, I'm referring to the A's, who have been moved from Oakland.
Stolen
from Oakland. They will be in Las Vegas in 2028, so they say. But they're in Sacramento for the next 3 years, which is... At a minor league park, yes. One of two major league teams, actually, playing this year at a minor league park.
And so, boy, when you watch those games on TV, you can really tell that it's a minor league park. It does not look or sound particularly good.
Yeah, and the players don't seem very happy about it. You know, the A's are kind of a fun team. Like, they've got some good players, like great pitching. At least that's how it seems, like watching them pitch against the Mets. But it does, I don't know, maybe I'm just projecting, but I do feel bad for them having to play, because a minor league ballpark has less good facilities than a major league ballpark.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. You didn't sign up to be called up from the minors to then go back to the minors again.
Like, and then on top of that, it seems like the ownership doesn't really care about fielding a competitive team until they get to Las Vegas. So it's the whole team is just kind of in limbo until then.
Yeah. An interesting thing happened this offseason where the A's had to get to a certain payroll number, because this was sort of negotiated within the collective bargaining agreement that teams in smaller markets, they get revenue sharing checks so that they can remain solvent from the teams in bigger markets who make exponentially more money than them and remain competitive. That's at least the theory behind it. But the A's were in a big market. The San Francisco Bay Area is a large market by any metric, population, you know, money, TV viewership, any of these things. And they had been running their team like a small market for so long, and they had all these, you know, different expenses and uncertainties related to not being able to find a new ballpark to replace the Oakland Coliseum, Alex's beloved Oakland Coliseum that he was alluding to, where they were playing for quite a while, for the last 40 years or so. And so the league agreed to give them revenue sharing checks in that time period to shore up their financials as they looked for a new ballpark. Well, that agreement expired this past offseason, and they would have had to go back to paying revenue sharing to the rest of the owners, to the small market owners, had they not spent enough money to put that money back on the field. So that's sort of a Byzantine way of describing it. They had a deadline. They had to spend enough money. And that amount of money was revealed earlier in the offseason, and it was they had to spend $105 million on payroll this year. And they were not that close to that. And so in the span of 3 weeks, they threw, I would say, above market value contracts at a bunch of free agents just to make sure that they signed those guys and cleared that number and didn't have to give back all of their revenue sharing money. Mm-hmm. And so it's funny. I mean, we talk about this game in such a like a macroeconomic and financial and labor oriented way, but this is what I'm talking about when I say that this really translates into what you're actually watching on the field and the product. Because, you know, Luis Severino, a guy who pitched for the Mets last year and who started his career on the New York Yankees, he just straight up would not be on the He would not be on the A's. They're not the Oakland A's anymore. He would not be on the A's if it were not for this specific financial metric that ownership was considering, because they paid above a premium value for him to bring him in so that they would hit that number. And I just find that funny, man. Yeah, I just find it funny that this is like, it's 2025 and we know all this stuff now, and we just have to accept that this is not just like a naked business operation that they're doing there.
And an added sad element of that is Severino came out recently and said he was begging the Mets to pay him even less, like he would take less to stay on the Mets, but it had to be, you know, within $6 million of the inflated figure, the A's. And I guess Stearns just decided maybe Severino's going to be washed up after this year or after 2 years, so it didn't happen. But yeah, Severino was like a huge part of the really fun 2024 Mets season, and I think we all Mets fans would have preferred him back over Montas, who, you know, is right. Haven't seen him pitch yet, but he's hard to believe he'll be better than Severino. Well, we'll see. You know, it seems like the Mets have some pitching magic going on.
here's the thing about David Stearns, right? Because he has been he has been a common point of discussion on our podcast.
Bobby fellow millennial.
Right. Fellow millennial. Exactly. Right. Love some representation in ownership offices. There were a lot of question marks when he came in, right? Are the Mets trying to like play like a mid-market team and, you know, sort of nibble around the edges or whatever? He's kind of earned the benefit of the doubt at this point, which is like, not to, you know, you can sort of look at any one situation or contract and say, I would have done this, I would have done that or whatever. Track record kind of speaks for itself. You guys might feel differently as people who sort of live the Mets more on a day-to-day basis, but I don't know. I'm curious to hear what y'all think on that.
Yeah, I agree. I think Stearns seems great. I mean, he was great. He did a great job with the Brewers, and I think the moves that he made in his first offseason translated into a Mets team in 2024 that, despite having such a high payroll, the parts all came together mid-season. And of course, they're not just like, you know, stats and parts that like clicked into shape at the right moment because of Stearns like brilliant assemblage of it, but also because of Lindor calling this clubhouse meeting where he got everyone on the same page, ignited this team spirit that helped them go on this run. But still, you know, Stearns got together a unexpectedly competitive team in that placeholder season. And now we're in a season where they're sort of expected to be one of the top teams in baseball. And so I guess we really have to see how that goes this year. You know, it could be if it turns out the pitching is a disaster, you know, that's something that might be on Stearns for not making some better moves in the offseason. But we'll see.
I mean, Alex, you know this, but because I've done this a million times on our podcast, and this has been sort of my corner of the baseball internet is like, it's my principle that we should just ask, are we sure that this middle manager deserves as much credit as he is getting when different presidents of baseball operation or general managers have been awarded credit for building a good team? I'm not totally convinced that like what they are doing has some special secret sauce that like only five guys really know how to do. I think more often it is like a collection of good, hardworking people in the room and the right mix of players in a clubhouse that leads to good teams. Like, that's my philosophy. And I think there are probably a handful of, you know, the Theo Epsteins, I now admit that David Stearns is probably one of these people who are like principled enough in their view of baseball and know enough. They have enough insights into what works in today's modern game, but also are just like good at motivating the people around them to buy into that shit. I think that is way more what makes like a good leader of an organization on the baseball operations side versus like, I just think this guy is a genius. He's gifted. You know, that's the way that we talk about these guys who run teams. And I think that is like a really limiting way, and it lacks a certain nuance that I think is weird and also like hero worshipy. And I don't think that's the job of the media to do. And I think we do it way too often in the media where we're just like, well, Theo Epstein is the curse breaker. He's a god, you know? And I'm just like, what about the guys on the team, you know, who were like good before Theo Epstein was there? You know, it's convenient narratively to talk about it in that way. But I just am like, we need to throw a little cold water on these certain situations before we see how they play out. It's not always a one-to-one fit where you take the guy from the Tampa Bay Rays who was like raised in their, you know, cutting edge analytics department, and you put him in the front office and it's like his principles are just going to apply and work. I don't really think that's the case. And we've seen it fail so many times that I've always been skeptical about a guy changing scenes and doing these sort of like mid-market cutting edge tactics on a big market team, like with David Stearns. And, I just got to say, I was wrong about Stearns. I wasn't wrong. I was like, that skepticism was proven to be not valid. So I have had to sort of like walk back a little bit of my apology form. Stearns.
Yeah, that's on accountability.
Yeah, yeah. And Alex, you know this. This is not something that I do very often. is not something I will not admit that I am wrong in a public or private forum very often.
Well, I do think the scouts and managers and even the GMs, especially when they have been scouts in the past, you know, are an important part of the team in terms of like choosing who takes the field and making personnel decisions. But of course, as leftists, we venerate the workers, the players themselves. So maybe now we can turn to this question of the MLBPA, and we want to talk about, we want to look forward to what the CBA negotiations in December 2026 will look like. Well, when would the negotiations actually start? Does it start at the expiration?
In theory, like all collective bargaining agreements, they are allowed to be negotiated before they are expired, but in sports, oftentimes, and definitely in baseball, there's not a whole lot of good faith or, you know, high pace back and forth that is going on until the expiration of this collective bargaining agreement. Because so many of these issues are the same issues from the last time, they know that there's no sense in giving up leverage before they absolutely have to. And so they'll probably have a few meetings, informal meetings, but they won't actually pass anything across the table really until the expiration of the current CBA.
And part of the reason why we know this is because Rob Manfred, the commissioner of Major League Baseball, came out and said, yeah, so we're going to have a lockout at the end of next season once the CBA expires, which on its face then indicates that you are not very interested in working towards getting an agreement in place prior to that expiration date, right? Because I think he recognizes that the lockout puts pressure on players, right? You can agree with it or not, but I think from the ownership perspective, right, Manfred as the de facto representative of ownership recognizes we want them to be on the back foot a little bit. And so it's actually not really on us to try and come to the table and make a good faith effort to get something done before the expiration of the CBA.
Yeah, and so the real question, I think, going into the CBA is about the salary cap and the salary floor, and then if there's going to be a lockout or a strike, if the union and the owners can't come to agreement on that. And so let's try to talk about why these things are important. First of all, a lockout or a strike is mostly annoying to fans, and it's annoying to fans in a way that could, like, tip the balance of power towards the owners or the workers, like in the 1994 strike, for example. There was this moment when the union went forward with a very militant stance of, like, willing, or actually I would say the owners had a bit more of a militant stance where they were willing to forfeit an entire season, maybe two seasons, to get a salary cap like they have in basketball or in football in order to curb salaries long term, in order to prevent, like, the Juan Soto signing, which is he's the highest paid athlete of all time, you know, up there with Otani. And so trying to prevent that in the long term, they wanted to try to put a cap on how much free agents could earn. And the strike began in the 1994 season and lasted till the early 1995 season. And featured some of the most militant talk we've seen from players, including John Franco saying he was going to, like, beat up scabs, and Bobby Bonilla as well. Like, it could have turned into a situation where players were picketing major league games. It didn't end up there. But I think that they had hoped that the fans would generally be on their side because they like the players. But then when the season resumed, there was this fan outrage day where fans showed up with signs and, like, game disruptions, like a group at Shea Stadium stormed the field throwing money at the players, calling them greedy and stuff. And the anger went towards both sides, but it went largely towards the players themselves. And so this thing where, like, the owners had suffered this huge loss because the Labor Relations Board and Sotomayor, as a federal justice at the time, ruled in favor of the players and put through this it was the luxury tax. This is where the luxury tax comes in instead of the salary cap. So the owners, if they spend too much, they have to share their revenue with smaller market teams. So that puts the expenditure limit amongst the owners instead of onto the players, instead of onto wages. But even though the owners suffered this huge loss, the players also suffered this huge loss because the fans now saw them as millionaires in conflict with billionaires. And for small market fans, they might even see the small market owners as on the same level or lower than the players. So the players lost a lot of their working class bona fides to the fans.
I think what we have to understand about the history of labor in baseball is that the 94-95 strike is like just a gigantic before and after moment in terms of perception of labor in baseball. The 80s saw work stoppages. There was a work stoppage in 1973 as well, but they were all much shorter. None of them canceled a postseason in a World Series like the 94 strike. And so, you know, we did see missed regular season games in the 1980s, but this was completely unprecedented territory. And I think the reason that this happened, Andy, is because of what you said, which is that the owners took this militant stance that this was the time that they wanted to get the thing that they had always wanted, which was a salary cap. Part of this stems from the fact that at the founding of the Major League Baseball Players Association, they didn't take that union seriously. This was like a company union when it was first started. It was actually violating national labor law about how it was being funded, because it was being funded by Major League Baseball. And they just didn't think that they should ever have to give anything up. I mean, this is how titans of industry operate. Certainly when you're in an industry that has a monopoly exemption given by the Supreme Court for specious reasons at best in the 1920s. And so, you know, they felt that this was their time. The 1990s, baseball was bigger than ever, and it was making more money than ever, in large part because of organization of the labor side. And we can talk about that more in a little bit. But they wanted to make a stand and establish a salary cap, and then it would be that way forever. Because once you win something like that in collective bargaining, it's very hard to undo, if not impossible to undo. And so they were willing to blow it up. And they didn't think that the players would have enough solidarity to interrupt that plan, because what that demanded was taking a group of 1,200, that's how many players at any one given time are on a major league roster, or a 40 man can be called up to the bigs at any time. They didn't think that these 1,200 guys, some of the most competitive people in the world, would be willing to give up their season for this cause. And it turns out that they were. And the owners took that risk by allowing the expired CBA to continue into the 1994 season. And when they did that, they gave the players the opportunity to vote and call a strike at any moment. And so they did, halfway through the season. And they hoped to get it solved and come back and play the World Series, but they didn't. And they missed the rest of that season, canceled everything. And then they came back in 1995 after Sotomayor ruled in their favor as unfair labor practices with the way that the owners handled this lockout, bad faith negotiating and whatnot. And I just don't think like anyone ever thought that it would come to that point. And because of that, the way that we find ourselves now, that will never happen again. The league will never let that happen again. They will lock the players out the day that the CBA expires, in perpetuity, forever. They will never give the players the opportunity to exercise with the power of withholding their labor midseason ever again, because they are too aligned from a corporate structure perspective, and they have been run by labor lawyers as commissioners for so long, labor lawyers or owners as the last two commissioners for the last 30 plus years, that they know from a principal operating perspective that they're never going to give the players that opportunity again. So I struggle to see a world in which we ever see a player strike again. It's just going to be lockouts all the way down.
Well, especially because, and I don't want to be too optimistic about kind of the perspective that the average fan takes on labor these days, but the dynamic is very, very different from where it was in the 94-95 season. Like, again, I think ownership knew that the players would receive some backlash, right? Because again, they had been sort of controlling the streams of information that fans were receiving, and they knew that they could relatively easily paint them as greedy, right? As these, you know, as playing a child's game, right? You're bargaining over pennies here or there, but you get to go out and you know, swing the bat and run around the bases. And isn't that just the dream? You're living the dream, right? You should be grateful. And that's what the players had been told for decades, for really the prior century.
It's men playing a boy's game, they say.
Exactly. And frankly, I think that if something like that happened today, I mean, I don't want to suggest that fans would en masse come out in support of players, but as we have seen in some of these labor squabbles in the last few years around whether in the shortened COVID season or the subsequent negotiation of a CBA, the tenor has changed a little bit. I think fans are a little more willing to call the ownership class out and say, guys, really? Like, this is where you're drawing the line, is, you know, over a 60 game season or something like that. So, I mean, to Bobby's point, I don't think they'll ever let it get to that place again, because they are reasonably afraid of what that could mean to their power.
So the ownership class, I agree, seems more unified than it ever has been before. You know, another result of the 94 strike was the two leagues merging into essentially one corporation, the MLB. You get the start of interleague play, and now you get this situation where every team plays every team, and there's no real distinction between the AL and NL anymore, and we might be realigning, and so that there's actually no leagues anymore. And more than just affront to baseball tradition, that's a representation of how the factionalism in the baseball ownership class has broken down behind the united, a sort of united front against labor. And on the other hand, you have an MLBPA that is more divided than it has been ever as a result of this huge victory, which was the unionization of the minors. And something that, you know, one thing that I really want to get your opinion on is the unionization of the minors was this huge moment that came after the pandemic. I think they won it in 2022. And the result of that is the vast majority of the members of the MLBPA are minor league players. I think it's like 5-1, something like that. I think they have a slight majority in terms of the votes in the union, maybe like 51-49 or something, or maybe it's the other way. They balanced it between the major leaguers and the minor leaguers. But before the previous season in 2024, there was this mutiny that largely began amongst the minor leaguers against the leadership of the players union, where they said the players union is being run either by the agents of the top paid stars or by the top paid players themselves. And now the majority of the union are more middle class and working class players. And it was very unclear about, besides just like a crisis of authority in union leadership, what that really meant in terms of what they wanted in the next CBA or what they didn't like about the previous CBA. And one rumor that I've seen sort of floated is that the minor league players actually want the salary cap because it'll come with a salary floor. And while it will depress wages for people like Juan Soto long term, it'll increase wages for the majority of players indefinitely, possibly. So do you think that's actually part of this averted mutiny, and like that actually the players might be interested in the salary cap in the next CBA?
I think it's such a fascinating question, because it's really hard to tell, because the membership of the Major League Baseball Players Association is so diverse. I mean, both diverse from a background perspective, diverse from a player pool perspective. Like, you have different factions within, even prior to the unionization of the minors, within the Players Association who feel that their group of players has been treated wrongly throughout the entire history of baseball organized labor. I mean, relief pitchers, for example. Relief pitchers have been getting shafted by the quote-unquote the free market for time immemorial. I mean, they don't get the credit for what they come in and do. Their raw counting numbers are never as much as starting pitchers, and so they don't get paid in the way that starting pitchers do. But a team can't operate without relief pitchers. You have a terrible bullpen, you have a terrible team. So you could argue qualitatively, these guys should be getting paid more than they're getting paid. Now, that those issues compound when you throw in the fact that it's like, now there's all of these minor league players and they're getting paid drastically different amounts. I don't know that I would believe the rumor that minor league players are driving the desire for a salary cap. I think that there are a certain number of like intellectually uncurious major leaguers who just think that a salary cap would clean up the fight. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be like, we're done arguing about this stuff. And now we look to our friends in other sports and we see they don't have the kind of labor strife that we have every 3 years. They don't have the same arguments that we're having every 3 years. They sit around and they quibble over, you know, how much of this money should be split in the revenue share between the players and the owners. And that seems pretty easy. And I seem like that seems like I might be interested in that. Now, to understand why it's so important to the Major League Baseball Players Association to never have a salary cap, we should probably talk about Marvin Miller a little bit, who was the first actually elected head of the Major League Baseball Players Association. And he came from he came from an organized labor background. He worked for the National Labor Relations Board during the war, during World War II. And then after that point, he was very high up in the U.S. Steelworkers.
And he's a Brooklyn Dodgers fan.
And is a Brooklyn Dodgers. Diehard Brooklyn Dodgers fan who had loved baseball his whole life growing up. And he came in and he was staunchly against a salary cap forever because he felt that a free market was the only way for players to be able to individually negotiate against these owners. So why would you limit and tell the owners that this is as much as they have to pay? If you are just principled from the top to the bottom and the bottom back up to the top, you can get more out of these owners. And it's interesting because you bring up agents, Andy. I think agents have had an interesting longitudinal effect on the economics of the game, because for an agent, if you just get your top player paid, you're good, you know? And that's not really how all of these agents operate, but knowing that in the back of your subconscious that like you're financially set just by getting one player paid for your whole agency, you just don't have to fight as hard for the guys who are making less.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've seen that owners are always going to squeeze that middle to lower tier of player because they know that those players don't have leverage individually. And that for a lot of different reasons, the union has not always protected those players as much as it protects the top earners. Not even just that it protects them, but that it's just the top earners are never going to get squeezed because there's only like 10 guys who can do what they do. Unless we're in like a full-on capital strike, which at various points in the last 10 years we kind of have been. But yeah, I don't know. What do you think, Alex? I mean, the salary cap question is always going to come up every 3 years. I don't think it's ever going to happen. But owners know that it's this boogeyman that they can toss out into the ether, and enough people are going to hang on to it and have a bunch of angst over it that they can then walk it back and get these other demands around the edges, and they can win in the CBA negotiation. That's my opinion on this, on the state of things.
Yeah, I mean, that's roughly where I stand as well. I mean, I think part of it comes down to how well educated the current class of members is educated on the history of the labor struggle, honestly. I mean, you mentioned Marvin Miller, right? Like the rapid gains that were achieved by players from basically like the 60s to the 80s, from a labor perspective, were remarkable, right? And all of that is underpinned by this idea of you as the workers have the power, right? And you shouldn't be giving up that leverage to owners that they had largely volunteered away from since the genesis of the league's founding. And he comes in and he treats the players like they are human beings, like they are laborers like anyone else, and says, look, yeah, you're playing a child's game, but like you're still creating money out of that. You were still creating value for someone else. And so you're worried about the pensions and stuff, but you have these restrictive clauses like free agency. You don't have an independent like arbitrator. You have a long way to go. And he builds over the course of 2 to 3 decades this incredibly strong unit. And he is really the reason why the players union, the baseball players union, was considered for many decades the strongest out of all the, you know, major sports unions. And frankly, I even beyond sports, just in the labor landscape in the U.S. in general, Tony Clark has said very plainly, we will never accept a salary cap, right? And that's, I mean, he has to as the head of the union, but I think that he also believes that. I do think that the sort of top brass of the Players Association is simply not interested in entertaining that idea.
Okay. And yeah, I hope you're right, because I do think, even though the concerns about the leadership of the PA being too tilted towards the stars, the highest paid players, there's probably something very accurate there. And the fact that the minor leaguers are, you know, now a big part of the conversation, I think it'll change the dynamics and hopefully make the majority of players better represented in it. But at the same time, like you said, the owners are united. They'll probably launch a lockout. They're already sort of implying that they will. And they could have this lockout for as long as it takes to get the cap if that's what they want. Now we don't have the NLRB, the NLRB might be back operational by that point. We'll mm-hmm. have to see what happens in like the midterm elections, or, you know, what kind of Supreme Court rulings come down against the NLRB. But the protection that the union had in 94, they're not going to have now. So it's, I think it, the owners have a lot more leverage now than they did then, both in terms of the union being somewhat divided and in terms of it being a really bad situation for labor in general in this country.
But yeah. I will say I was also told it was catastrophic for ownership to miss any games whatsoever.
Right.
Right. I, when you go back to the 2020 season, which they shortened to 60 games, right? For frankly, years after that, they came out and said this hurt our bottom line so much, right? Like we just, every baseball team lost so much money then. And so by that logic, you would think that they feel like there is far too much at risk, you know, to lock the players out for an extended period of time over something like this. I think it maybe speaks to the fact that they're not being entirely forthcoming about how much money is moving around in this sport. Because I think once you open the books and you peel back those layers, like it becomes very evident that things are not on the up and up as when it comes to their revenues.
Can I add something to that though? I mean, everything that you said about the NLRB hits very close to home for me personally as someone who, like, when the NLRB was actually functioning, like helped organize a union at my company and like we joined onto the Writers Guild, and without a functioning NLRB, like I don't know how any of that would have gone or if it would have gone. And when I think about like the collective labor movement of the 2010s and in places like Starbucks and Amazon being like two of the things that we can champion as like a win for labor, despite many of the setbacks along the way at those two companies and the organized labor history of them. Like without a functioning NLRB, which we haven't had at certain moments during that period, like that just doesn't happen at all, you know, because that is all about the bureaucracy of how those elections are filed and acknowledged. And the company is so much bigger than the union when it comes to those fights. For the Players Association versus the owners, I mean, these players are some of the most powerful people in relationship to their owners in any industry in the world. Like, the games don't happen without them. And now that the minor leaguers are unionized too, like they're not going to get scab players either. So if it's a lockout, like it's a lockout and there's no games happening. And to Alex's point, like they've been telling us for the last 5 years, crying poor about how they need every single gate revenue that they can possibly get to remain solvent, even though that's a lie. But, you know, you start to see like, these games don't happen without these players, and these players have been making a lot of money. And if they're going to remain principled over this sort of thing, like they're not going to just give in quickly. And we've seen throughout baseball history, labor history, that there have been a lot of times where the owners are like, we're going to lock out the players and we're going to give them their medicine and we're going to get a win. And then like, they're actually the side that panics faster more often than not, because for a number of reasons, because they have disagreements amongst them. They have big personalities in that room. They're not actually as organized on all things as we might think they are sometimes. Like when the going gets tough, you have certain owners who are like, I'm leveraged out the ass. I need this money right now. I rely on this revenue sharing check right now in terms of my 360 degree business view and how I run my finances. And I just can't afford to miss 6 months of baseball revenue. And then you have other owners who are like, I could never get another cent from this team and I would be fine. And so would my kids, kids and their kids, kids, kids. And so, you know, acknowledging the fact that like all these guys are rich enough that they don't really need these baseball teams, like they still want them. They still want that revenue and they still rely on that revenue. And so I actually, if it were up to me, and I'm not a betting man, but if I had to bet on one side during a lockout where they're fighting over a salary cap, I would bet on the player side. I would bet on the organized labor side every time, because this is truly an example of like, these guys are irreplaceable. The owners need the players way more than the players need the owners.
All right. Well, I hope you're right about that. We will find out in 2 years, I guess. But I want to transition now to talking about more of the social repercussions of this, or the social parallels, because when Miller came in, you know, he was able to win the election as the union president with bread and butter issues, but he was really able to mobilize the union towards a more aggressive stance, towards a strike in 1969 and defeating the reserve clause, or like amending the reserve clause in the 70s based on the self-activity of players, especially black players, in 68 when they decided to have something like a wildcat strike, not to play until Martin Luther King's funeral. And so this was a major labor action. There had been a couple precedents of players complaining about racism and like holding out for better contracts that inspired Miller. But I think Miller understood that the players that were coming up in the 60s were far less conservative than the players who came up in the 40s and 50s, largely because of integration, but also just because of like the cultural shift in the United States, like the whole counterculture and social movement. And he thought that these players were ready to actually have some class consciousness, to actually confront the ownership. This was true, I think, also in 94 when the players were so militant, like I said. And I think a lot of that had to do with the bad position labor was in as a result of NAFTA, as a result of deindustrialization. And so there was like a kind of a consciousness of the players that they were workers like any other union worker. Now, so I think there has to be some broader social consciousness to really get players to have solidarity and to fight. And there has to be some social consciousness amongst the fans as well. And today in baseball, we are in this sort of depoliticized moment. Mm-hmm. You know, it hasn't been that way for a very long time. Like in 2020, there was a walkout in support of the George Floyd uprising, essentially, following the shooting in Kenosha. So it's not impossible for players to become more socially conscious or class conscious again. But I do think there has to be, you know, in basketball, for instance, players, I think, are way more free to speak their mind, you know, for better or worse. I think it's in general, it's better that they get to speak their mind. And in baseball over the last year, you just didn't see players talk about anything political, like the war in Gaza. You know, we had the gay grimace Mets, and they seemed to enjoy they had some fun with like their fans calling them gay and stuff, which was nice to see. But they never said anything about like the horribly bigoted Trump ads running during the postseason, or, you know, some of their wives on Instagram talked about, like Sean Manaea's wife talked about the war in Gaza, and Francisco Lindor's wife Katia talked about Amani Khalif. But the players themselves don't make these political statements. And so that's a little bit concerning to me, not just because, like, I think as a leftist, it would be cool if the players were a little bit more politically open, and not just about how much they love Trump. That seems to be, like, the most of the politics coming out from players. But also just because I think it'll make the union struggle stronger and more resonant.
Yeah. Good times create weak men, I think. I mean, honestly, I think that baseball for a long time has been, you know, has skewed conservative both in its like labor class of players and also like the fan base. Part of that is very structural, right? Part of that is because it, especially in today's day and age, it's really expensive to play baseball growing up as a kid. If you actually want access to all of the resources, you are going to be coming from a certain class.
Yeah. So we basically have a situation where we have a lot of white middle class American players, and then a lot of players who are Caribbean trained in these sort of sweatshop like academies.
Yeah. Right.
And almost no African American players, which is really sad.
Yeah. So I think like the conditions are not ripe, frankly, for this sort of I don't know, outburst of just political vigor or anything like that, because I think a lot of them, I mean, either don't care or frankly lean towards whatever's going on in the White House right now, because they make a lot of money and they want to pay less taxes, right? And like at the end of the day, that's kind of what it comes down to for them. We have sort of these individual cases, and I really hope, you know, that the Katia Lindors of the world can rally all the wags to make more statements and stuff. But I don't know. You're right. It, like, we're in a bit of a bleak place right now when it comes to player sentiment publicly.
Yeah. I think when it comes to social issues, I just think most of these guys honestly don't think that critically about these things. Like, I think that they have used sports and baseball and whatever upbringing they come from as a sort of like blanket response to how they formed their ideologies on some of these things. Most, I would argue that like it feels like baseball's really conservative. I would argue that baseball is basically apolitical. And like there's enough guys who just kind of go with whatever way the wind is blowing when it comes to social issues. And just like your average kind of guy out there in the world who you might be your coworker or might be your uncle or might be your parents' friend or whatever. And it's just like, they maybe think about the issue of the day, but they don't think critically or structurally about these things all that often. I think more guys do think critically and structurally about like the financial issues that they face in the game. And it's so fascinating to see that in contrast. I mean, it's been fascinating and it's been honestly agonizing for us at certain points throughout us doing this show, doing Tipping Pitches, which is like, how can you be so principled when it comes to how you will act in concert with the Major League Baseball Players Association and just not care at all about how that functions in the rest of the world is a question that I find myself asking pretty often. But like, I think that just goes to show how if you make these issues local, it has much more of an impact. You know, like a baseball player is much more likely to understand why they need to act principally and help out the person next to them when it's literally their teammate. And so it's like, how does that not apply to other places is a question, you know, we are asking ourselves often. And the answer to that is that like most people are pretty self-interested. I think that there's like a certain American mentality that is like, make sure you take care of yourself and like the people immediately around you, but then anyone else you kind of don't know that well, it's kind of hit or miss whether or not you care. And that is one of the things that I think the Players Association could and should, if I could say so, if I could give them this little note here on this podcast, should get back to about like caring about relating these struggles that they are going through against the oligarchy class, which now is, it's not just the industrialists that are Major League Baseball owners. Like these guys are everywhere now. We talked about it with Guggenheim. Like every baseball owner has like a negative social impact in many different industries at this point now, just because of the nature of global capital. And so I think that the Players Association could and should be doing a little bit more to talk about the ways in which these struggles relate to the rest of society and what's happening to people all throughout this country.
You just heard the first half of our discussion with Bobby and Alex. And in the second half, we're going to be talking more about social consciousness in baseball, what the players might want, maybe our own utopian visions for how baseball could be better, and my bong rip theory about the ontological nature of baseball and American politics. If you want to hear that, you can hear that for free on our Patreon. Just sign up for a free membership. And while you're there, if you want to support the show and hear all of our paywalled content and get access to our Discord community, you can do that by signing up for $5 a month, for $10 a month, or what we really appreciate is you sign up for a full year. You get a recession discount if you sign up for the full year. We really appreciate people who do that. And so check out patreon.com/theantifada to hear the rest of our episode with the Tipping Pitches podcast. Mattingly and Canseco, Ken Griffey's grotesquely swollen jaw, Steve Sachs and his running with the law. We're talking Homer, Ozzie and the Straw. We're talking softball from Maine to San Diego. Talking softball, Mattingly and Canseco, Ken Griffey's grotesquely swollen jaw, Steve Sachs and his running with the law. We're talking Homer, Ozzie and the Straw.